deadlines. A senior Iranian source tells Press TV that Tehran won't accept a gradual removal of US sanctions or any talks with Washington before all sanctions are lifted. Yemen's defense minister warns Saudi Arabia against pushing ahead with its aggression, saying Sana'a can hit many targets deep inside the kingdom. Also coming up, protesters take to the streets of cities across Algeria demanding an independent judiciary as dozens of opponents endure incarceration. Welcome to World News. It's good to have you with us. Out of Syria, an informed source has told Press TV that the United States has no option but to remove all anti-Iran sanctions. The source says that is the only way forward to persuade Tehran to halt the rollback of its commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal.
Iran and the other signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, held virtual talks on Friday to discuss the fate of the agreement. During the meeting attended by China, Russia, France, Germany, and Britain, along with Iran, the signatories agreed to hold in-person talks in Vienna on Tuesday. That will be part of the meetings of the Joint Commission of the Nuclear Deal. Later, White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki claimed there will be indirect talks with Iran in Vienna.
These talks will be structured around working groups that the EU is going to form with the remaining partners in the JCPOA, including Iran. And the primary issues that will be discussed are the nuclear steps that Iran would need to take in order to return to compliance with the JCPOA, and the sanctions relief steps the United States would need to take in order to return to compliance.
But an informed Iranian source told Press TV that Tehran will hold no direct or indirect talks with Washington before it removes all anti-Iranian sanctions.
According to the immutable guidelines set out by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, any outcome of the joint JCPOA commission meeting, which is based on the notion of step-by-step removal of sanctions, is unacceptable. According to the guidelines by the leader, the Islamic Republic will only return to its JCPOA commitments after the removal of all US sanctions and Iran's verification of the move. The Islamic Republic will not hold any mediated or unmediated talks with the US before all sanctions are lifted. Just as the US left the 2015 nuclear deal without negotiations and imposed sanctions on Iran, it should now remove all sanctions without talks.
Iran signed into the 2015 nuclear deal and committed itself to limiting its civilian nuclear program in exchange for removal of all nuclear-related sanctions against the country. That was meant to ensure Iran benefits economically from the accord, but those benefits were scarce and fully evaporated after the former U.S. administration withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and imposed unilateral sanctions against Iran. Analysts say all Iran is saying is that a once-negotiated deal does not need to be renegotiated.
The deal was the result of negotiations. So the negotiations have already taken place. The deal tells all sides what they're supposed to do. So the Americans know exactly what they're supposed to do. There's nothing to negotiate. If they want the deal to work, they have to implement it. But if they want to take bits and pieces and think that they can gain concessions from Iran, Iran is not going to do that.
Almost 3 months into the Biden administration, Washington is yet to right Donald Trump's wrongs on the nuclear deal. Tehran is clearly seeing through Washington's empty rhetoric and is calling for action. On Friday, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi told a virtual meeting on the nuclear deal that the remedial measures Iran took after the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear deal are reversible, but only after the removal of all anti-Iran sanctions and its verification by Tehran.
Yemen's defense minister warned Saudi Arabia against pushing ahead with its aggression against his country, saying Sana'a is capable of hitting many targets deep inside the kingdom. Mohammed Nasser al-Atifi said Yemen has been expanding its military capacities for launching retaliatory attacks. He said Yemen's growing military power cannot be compared with 6 years ago, when the Saudi-led coalition started an onslaught on the impoverished country. Riyadh launched the war in an attempt to reinstate the Saudi-allied former regime. The military campaign, coupled with an all-out blockade, has devastated most of Yemen's infrastructure and led to a massive humanitarian crisis. Yusuf Mowry is a Yemeni journalist and political analyst and joins us now. Yusuf, welcome. It's clear from the facts on the ground that Yemen today is not the Yemen of 6 years ago. Something new has emerged. We're seeing, you know, tit for tat now, attacks. When the Saudis attack, the Yemenis hit back. How much longer can the Saudis afford to continue their war on Yemen?
Well, for not much longer, and this is exactly why they offered this initiative, the initiative which called on Ansar Allah to stop their advancement in the province of Ma'rib, and in return, Saudi Arabia is willing to lift the blockade, and Saudi Arabia is willing to open Sana'a International Airport temporarily. Of course, that initiative was rejected by the Ansar Allah movement because their demand was that if Saudi Arabia wants to engage in any forms of negotiations, they first must lift the blockade and open Sana'a International Airport in order for there to be a comprehensive dialogue between both sides of the conflict. But again, Ansar Allah, they rejected that deal, and they even fired a series of retaliatory attacks, drone strikes, and missiles targeting Saudi oil facilities, targeting Saudi military bases, and targeting Saudi airports. And this is something that's happened across Saudi Arabia. So we can sense that the Saudi officials, the Saudi monarchy, they're in a perturbed state. They're getting nervous. They don't know what to do. So they go back, you know, they reach out to the UN and to the US, and, you know, they're having discussions on the situation in Yemen. And Saudi Arabia did not imagine that they would be in this position. They did not think that after 6 years, the Ansar Allah movement would be victorious. Ansar Allah movement would take over more territory. And the Saudi mercenaries are basically on their last leg in the province of Ma'rib. It's just a matter of a couple of more weeks before the province of Ma'rib falls under Ansar Allah control. And if that happens, the scale will tip in the favors of Ansar Allah. It's to the point where Ansar Allah doesn't even have to engage in negotiations, because if they continue to advance and if they continue to launch a series of attacks on Saudi Arabia, you know, Saudi Arabia is eventually going to put up the white flags, and if that's what it's going to take to get them to stop intervening in Yemen's political affairs, that's what Ansar Allah is dedicated to achieving, according to what they're saying.
Do you think, Yusuf, if Ma'rib falls to Ansar Allah forces, then, as you say, Saudi Arabia will wave the white flag because it's got nothing left? The southern regions of Aden, the separatists, you got movements there, allied to the UAE, so we can say the last patch of land that is aligned to the Saudi or Saudi-led militants is Ma'rib, and the Ansar Allah is on the verge of capturing it.
Saudi Arabia is never going to stop intervening in Yemen's political affairs. They're going to continue to meddle in Yemen one way or the other. So what I imagine will happen is, as soon as Ma'rib falls and Saudi Arabia loses its stronghold in the north of Yemen, as I said before, Saudi Arabia will then be forced to reshuffle their cards and reposition itself in the south of the country. So in other words, the UAE and Saudi Arabia are going to try to form this joint government in the south of the country consisting of southern separatists and perhaps the Hadi government. So that play is, you know, expect this play to be in the near future. As soon as Ma'rib falls, Saudi Arabia is going to reshift its focus to the south of the country, whereby they will try to establish some sort of government between the southern separatists and the government of Abdul Abu Mansur Hadi. Of course, though, the southern separatists, they're not really fond of President Hadi, and you know, they strongly oppose any type of unification between the southern separatists and the south in general with the north as we stand here today. So you know, that's going to lead to more conflict. Perhaps it's going to shape into a conflict of its own, whereby Ansar Allah will maintain control in the north and the south will be in a state of chaos and instability, because you have essentially two governments that are fighting for a larger piece of the pie. But, you know, I think on the ground, Ansarullah is expecting that as soon as this matter falls, Saudi Arabia will focus its attention, redirect its attention to the south of the country.
Right, and we've seen a lot of clashes there between Saudi-backed forces and UAE-backed militants. Yusuf, thank you very much indeed. Yusuf Murray, the Yemeni journalist and political analyst, joining us out of Detroit. Now moving on, thousands of anti-government protesters have taken to the streets in Algeria to support the Hirak pro-democracy movement. Demonstrations were held in the capital, Algiers, and several other cities across the country. Protesters called for an independent judiciary amid detention of dozens of anti-government opponents. The Hirak protest movement helped force longtime Algerian President Abdelaziz Bouteflika to step down in 2019. His successor, President Abdelmajid Tebboune, pledged to reform the country's power structure. However, protesters believe that the new administration has failed to fulfill its promise. The Hirak movement demands a new political system that reflects the will of Algerian people. And turning elsewhere, one of the two police officers targeted in a car ramming attack outside the U.S. Capitol building in Washington, D.C. has succumbed to his injuries. The second officer was transferred to hospital. The assailant was fatally shot by law enforcement officers when he got out of his vehicle. He was said to have been armed with what appeared to be a knife. Local police said the incident doesn't appear to be terror-related and that there are no ongoing threats. The attack prompted the authorities to put the building under lockdown. The motive behind the attack is not clear yet. The incident comes less than 3 months after supporters of former President Donald Trump stormed the Congress building in an attempt to overturn the 2020 election results. Staying in the United States, where more witnesses have testified on the fifth day of the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former police officer who killed unarmed African-American George Floyd in Minneapolis last year.
What is your view of that use of force during that time period?
Totally unnecessary.
What do you mean?
Pulling him down to the ground, face down, and putting your knee on the neck for that amount of time is just uncalled for. I saw no reason why the officers felt they were in danger, if that's what they felt.
Richard Zimmerman told the jury that kneeling on a person's neck can kill them. He said officers are responsible for the care of detainees and are trained to provide first aid if they are injured. The senior officer was called to testify whether Chauvin was following his police training correctly. During the arrest of George Floyd last May, Chauvin knelt on the victim's neck for about 9 minutes before he lost consciousness and died. The incident, filmed by bystanders, rocked the United States. It led to widespread protests against police mistreatment of African Americans. So, high-profile cases of black Americans dying at the hands of police officers have led to a racial reckoning in the U.S. A Minneapolis court is now trying a former officer who is accused of murdering an unarmed African-American man by kneeling on his neck. Will justice be served in this case?
The trial of former U.S. police officer Derek Chauvin began earlier this week. Chauvin is accused of killing 46-year-old African-American George Floyd by kneeling on his neck for more than 9 minutes during an arrest last May. Floyd's death triggered worldwide protests over brutal policing tactics and racial injustice. Prosecutors have said the former Minneapolis officer killed Floyd without regard for his life. They insist Chauvin betrayed his badge by kneeling on Floyd's neck and using excessive and unreasonable force as the black man kept begging for his life. The high-profile trial is expected to take 1 month. During the next few weeks, prosecutors will ask medical and use of force experts, among others, to testify. If convicted of murder and manslaughter charges, the former police officer could be jailed for decades. Chauvin has denied the charges. His defense lawyers argue that the force used during the arrest was reasonable and that Floyd died of an overdose and poor health. U.S. police officers who cause a death while they're on duty are rarely charged, and only about a third of those charged are convicted. This ongoing trial is followed across the U.S. and around the world as a strong indication of how the American legal system treats deaths in police custody.
The high-profile trial in the U.S. has once again brought the killing of George Floyd and the question of racial discrimination and police brutality in America back into the spotlight. As we will see in the next report, although the Floyd's death triggered mass protests, racial profiling, injustice and discrimination remain serious problems in America.
The ongoing trial has captured media attention in the U.S. and around the world. Everyone wants to know how the proceedings will end. But there is still a strong possibility that justice will not be served in Floyd's case, just as it wasn't served in many other high-profile police killings of unarmed African Americans over the past years. The 2014 police killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson was another example in which the white officer who shot the black man was not indicted. Black Americans are disproportionately more likely to be fatally shot by police and arrested for drug abuse, and five times more likely than white Americans to be imprisoned. Experts believe ethnic minorities in America, especially African Americans, are facing a very deep-rooted problem that will not be resolved anytime soon.
Black people in the United States are incarcerated, jailed, locked up, arrested, more than any other race at more than any other rate in this country, disproportionate to their percentage of the population. Even though black people in the United States represent just over 13% of the population, they're targeted and they're victimized more to the prison industrial complex more than any other group in the United States. And that's something that we really have to begin to tackle in the United States to understand the roots of the prison industrial complex, of the police as catchers of enslaved people.
Observers largely attribute this trend to the racist roots of American policing and social structures. Law enforcement in many U.S. states, especially those in the south of the United States, have their roots in slave patrols that were formed centuries ago. Such patrols located and forcefully returned enslaved people who had escaped.
The first reason for police to begin with to exist in the United States were to catch enslaved people who liberated themselves from their owners who fled to the north. And that's why you'll see the first badges of the police from the 1800s said the words slave patrol, because that was one of their first jobs, to catch liberated enslaved peoples who were running to the north for freedom, for economic opportunity. That's the roots of policing in the United States, and we have to contend with that in order to deal with this.
The federal government banned the use of racist regulations at the state and local level many decades ago. Yet, ethnic minorities are subject to discrimination and profiling. Former U.S. President Donald Trump gained notoriety for fueling racial tensions and discrimination through provocative comments and stances. His successor, Joe Biden, has been an outspoken critic of racial injustice. But it remains to be seen whether he can truly lead the U.S. towards a less racially discriminative future.
Brings the end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
limelight.
As rich nations and pharmaceutical companies face sustained calls to share COVID-19 vaccine knowledge, the head of the World Health Organization has recently decried the grotesque global inequality of vaccine distribution, says Andrea Germanas, writer, in an article published under the heading, WHO Chief Blasts Grotesque Vaccine Inequality as Rich Nations Block Speedy End of Global Pandemic. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Rich nations like the United States and pharmaceutical companies face sustained calls to share COVID-19 vaccine knowledge, the head of the World Health Organization has recently decried the grotesque global inequality of vaccine distribution. In January, I said that the world was on the brink of a catastrophic moral failure unless urgent steps were taken to ensure equitable distribution of vaccines, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom said at a press conference. We have the means to avert this failure, he said, but it's shocking how little has been done to avert it. The gap in vaccine distribution, said Tedros, ultimately hurts all nations' effort to defeat the virus. The inequitable distribution of vaccines is not just a moral outrage, said Tedros. It's also economically and epidemiologically self-defeating. As long as the virus continues to circulate anywhere, people will continue to die, trade and travel will continue to be disrupted, and the economic recovery will be further delayed, the WHO chief said. Analysis from Agence France-Presse puts the inequality in stark terms. Some 56% of the doses have been administered in high-income countries, accounting for 16% of the global population. Just 0.1% have been administered in the 29 lowest-income countries, home to 9% of the global population. The toll in Africa, the New York Times reported, could be especially profound. Though it has 17% of the global population, the continent has administered roughly 2% of the vaccine doses given globally. Putting focus on Kenya, one of the countries relying on the WHO-backed vaccine distribution scheme known as COVAX, the Times said that cases there are soaring and gave a sobering projection. Even under the best of circumstances, the country is expecting to inoculate only 30% of its people, or about 16 million out of almost 50 million by the middle of 2023, when the rest of the population will get their shots, in anybody's guess. Some public health experts, including Tedros and progressive groups like the People's Vaccine Alliance, have been calling for a suspension in the World Trade Organization's intellectual property rules to allow other companies to produce the vaccine and thus widen the scope and the scale of doses. But as the Times reported, governments have resisted. By partnering with drug companies, Western leaders bought their way to the front of the line. But they also ignored years of warnings and explicit calls from the World Health Organization to include contract language that would have guaranteed doses for poor countries or encouraged companies to share their knowledge and the patents they control. It was like a run on toilet paper. Everybody was like, get out of my way, I'm gonna get that last package of German, said Greg Gonzalez, a Yale epidemiologist. He added, we just ran for the doses. A proposal from South Africa and India, and backed by scores of other nations, urges a waiver in the WTO rule, but richer nations, including the US and UK, blocked a measure to do exactly that earlier this month. A global pandemic requires a global effort to end it. That includes sharing critical info so other countries can produce the vaccine. According to reports citing a leaked copy of the negotiating text of a WHO resolution, wealthy nations are pushing back on provisions in international law to help poorer nations produce more vaccines. From the news outlet, the WHO does not have the authority to sidestep patents, but it is trying to bring countries together to find a way to bolster vaccine supplies. The discussions include using provisions in international law to get around patents and helping countries to have the technical ability to make them. But the drug industry argues that eroding patents would hinder its ability to invest in future treatments for COVID and other illnesses. Earlier this month, representatives of the U.S. drug industry wrote to U.S. President Joe Biden to share their concerns, but that sharing of vaccine knowledge is a crucial component of ending vaccine inequality and thus the global pandemic. According to a call released recently backed by over 1,000 scientists and public health experts, we must use vaccines this year to control the pandemic around the entire world, not just in a few high-income countries, they wrote. In a world where there are enormous inequalities, they wrote, COVID vaccinations offer us the opportunity to provide everyone globally, regardless of income, race, or nationality, immunological equity to be protected from SARS-CoV-2. UK-based organization Global Justice Now issued a similar message. The COVID-19 pandemic will not be over for us until it is over for everyone, the group tweeted. We can't end the COVID-19 pandemic this year, the group said, but pharma giants are standing in the way.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality. That's right. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haidar. Here in the studio, we have with us Sayyid Mohsin and Sheikh Yasser. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
the akhlaq of the Japanese is quite interesting. If you do, like, I don't know, because they taught us business Japanese. Don't ask me to say any of it because I'm not a very good student of Japanese. And then, but they taught us about how, you know, bowing and the traditional respect that you have to give, even to modern day businessmen. You know, if you're about to go into the elevator, make sure you say, you know, you go first, and then go yourself. If they offer you food, you have to reject it something like twice or three times or something like that. There was this kind of akhlaq that existed, and remnants of it still exist today, although American culture has completely demolished a great deal of it today, and they've become completely westernized to a lesser or greater extent, unfortunately.
One of the things that, you know, Islam stresses upon is akhlaq, right? But it doesn't mean that Islam brought akhlaq, right? The famous tradition of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, you know, who says that I was not sent but as someone to perfect akhlaq. That word perfection is important here. Meaning what? Meaning that there is already akhlaq within societies. It's already there.
Right.
If you need to perfect something, it means there's something there that you need to frame, shape, fashion, you know, guide in the proper place. So Islam did not come to give you akhlaq. The Arabs, even at that time, no matter how you call them, jahil, whatever you want to call it, they had certain akhlaq that Islam took and guided. There were certain things, yes, Islam gradually destroyed, or something that Islam completely smashed from the onset. So same here. It is possible, very possible, that in that part of the world, there was a certain prophet who was sent. We believe that all people had a certain prophet, whoever that prophet may be. You know, we say there's 124,000 prophets that were sent that we know of. Only what? 30 of them? Something 40 of them?
30, yeah.
Maybe. Even then, we know the name only. We know nothing about them.
Yeah.
There's nothing written about them in the Ahadith. There's nothing written about them in the Holy Quran, for example. So it's possible that a prophet was sent to those people.
Yeah.
And those ethics were taken from that particular prophet. And they kept it until, obviously, the next prophet, which was the, you know, good old Hollywood, came and destroyed it.
The anti-prophet.
The anti-prophet, if you want to call it prophet, in terms of inverted commas.
So this is just like kind of prerequisite to the actual discussion, which I'm going to dive into in a moment. But I wanted to get your initial thoughts on this, Sayed. So,
as Sheikh Yasser has mentioned, yes, there is no nation who do not have any prophet amongst them, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when he has created us, no matter whether they're the Japanese, Chinese, I don't know, Africans or Indians or maybe Americans or Britishers, Allah has sent prophets for everyone, for everyone's guidance. There was a prophet. And these ethics that we see in the society, the good ethics that we see, or akhlaq that we see in the society, these were taught by the prophets themselves.
Right.
It was the prophets of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For example, you just give the example of the Japanese. In Hindus as well, the Indians and the Hindus who worship idols, obviously they have the ethics as well. Like they touch the feet of the parents in respect when they enter, or they get like this, they should like wipe on their heads as a respect, like to show like they're on top of them. And there are many other things. For example, whale, covering head. It's in Indian culture. It's in the Japanese as well. You know, in the previous, like the old movies, if you watch like the American movies or Britishers, they used to have a hat with the kind of whale on in front of it.
No, actually, even we have video evidence from like just about 100 years back. Video evidence, if you can imagine this black and white footage of a British street, and there are hundreds of women walking down the street, and they are wearing, I don't want to say covered, they are wearing hijab. Forget hijab, they are wearing chadors.
Yes.
Have you seen this?
No.
It was recently recovered from the archives. I think it's Birmingham or one of the other cities, and it is absolutely fascinating. Like, every single woman on the street, there's loads of men there as well, every single woman, even the young women, they are all wearing like proper hijab. But no, this was just a prerequisite. This is like the beginning of the discussion. Now, the Japanese, they do have, to bring it back to the Japanese, they do have this kind of akhlaqi, clean kind of, they have a way of doing things. You know, if you look at their art, the anime that exists in the modern world, you go back in their history, you look at the samurai, the ninja culture, they all had a way of sitting, a way of farming, a way of speaking to one another, and a set of moral codes and conducts which they followed. In the modern world, there are such strange phenomena unfolding in Japan. So have you heard of this Minister of Loneliness to stop suicides from taking place?
Yes, recently the Prime Minister of Japan, he has appointed a new ministry as the Minister of Loneliness, while obviously this was happened first in Britain,
mm-hmm.
that the British government, due to this pandemic that is going on, they appointed a Minister of Loneliness, and then later the Japan, when they saw there is an increase in suicide, and they also appointed a room as well and a Minister of Loneliness. This Minister of Loneliness was a first minister. He was in charge of the campaign for bringing kids. Obviously, they're also facing this pandemic. They have this issue as well, that they have less children or less kids, and the child poverty. So he was fighting against all these things. And recently, he's been appointed as the Minister of Loneliness in order to decrease the ratio of suicide that is happening.
Japan is famous for lots of suicides.
And more than Japan, it is South Korea. If we look at the ratio of suicide, South Korea is number one.
Wow.
It's
really
higher than the Japan, but obviously Japan is more famous because of being in the media and all those
South
things.
Korea is only famous because of North Korea. Sheikh, what's your idea on this? I mean, have you heard of the suicide forest?
I've heard of something,
yeah.
And I know like there was a stat a while back. Obviously, it must have changed, obviously, that you had two countries that in terms of materialistic growth were far more advanced than majority of countries in the world, right? One was Japan, obviously, and the other one was Sweden, right? This was something that was known in terms of materialistic growth, infrastructure, organization.
The best lifestyle.
Your lifestyle, the physical, material lifestyle, the things you can do were second to none.
Yeah.
But yet, something was missing in that people were committing suicide at an astonishing rate in these two countries.
They had houses, they had great education, great cars, great food, clean water. Everything.
Organization, free education, free health.
Wow.
Obviously, but people are still committing suicide. Why?
Mm.
And I remember many times when I first came to Iran, people always ask, I'm sure you once said, I've been asked, where is better, here or there? And in Iran or where you come from? I've been asked this question many times by many people in many different cities.
Every day
as well in the taxi. So I always used to give this answer. I said, look, and I would give this answer of Japan and Sweden. I said, look, those countries have everything that you would ever want at your fingertip. But yet there's something missing. I said that here you have the ability to grow as a human being. It creates a human being. What is the difference between me and that normal animal who just eats, sleeps, works, you know, and procreates?
Mrs. Nerg.
Yeah, there's no difference. Right? I work, I get rewarded for it. I pay my dues, I get rewarded for it. What's the difference?
Yeah.
There's something missing.
You shoplift, you get punished.
Exactly. You know, I steal food from the cupboard, I get punished. Even in the prisons or something, I don't know if you've seen that prison in Norway that they've currently shown. It's like you have a kitchen, you have big screen TV, you have Nintendo, and God knows what else inside the prison.
Take me to that prison now.
Check it. There's a prison in Norway like that. But it was one thing missing, right? Even if they have all of those ethics, all those etiquettes, it's for what? What is the objective? Why are you doing it? Are you doing it just because it's a custom? Or is there a greater goal behind it? Even as we mentioned, that even if a prophet did bring it, even if a prophet didn't bring it, it is human nature to be good to others.
Yeah.
Right? Before, now human nature, we've destroyed our own human natures, right? Even if that is the case, but why are you doing it? Yeah. Are you doing it for the act itself, or are you doing it for something else? Therefore, the discussion then goes to the next level. What is your intention?
Mm.
Is your intention just the sake of doing it? Therefore, there is nothing beyond it.
Mm.
The action is that action itself. It has no benefit to you
mm.
or to the other person.
Right.
Because there's no objective to it. It is hanging. It's floating,
mm.
basically. So this is one issue that we can discuss. Even if you are showing, even worse, you are doing it to show off. This is even worse than the first one. Because
mm.
the first one, you're just doing it as a custom. You're not doing it to show off. The next one, no, you're doing it in order to show that I have the customs. You know, I still mm. practice them. You don't. Just learn from me.
I mean, it's so true. There is something vital missing, even if you can provide all that basic, the basic, what people see as the basic necessities. But I started by asking Sheikh Yasser a question about the suicide forest, and he said, I know something.
I know something about the forest. This is where they had all these programs come from, right? They go into this jungle, and all these ghosts and stuff come from these Japanese horror movies.
No.
There's a problem. There's a problem in this society.
I want to mention about the forest. Let me mention this, and then I'll take your point. So there's a real forest where people just go there to commit suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go into that forest, there's a sign outside that says, you know, think about the people that love you and, you know, you've still got your whole life ahead of you, all that stuff. But if you go inside, there's actually corpses, like just hanging from trees, shoes and things like that.
And they just leave it.
The people just go and they wander off into that forest and they never come out again.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's happened. And Japan, I mean, imagine everything that you could have, like you said, everything at your fingertips. Like imagine American society, but you're not getting shot at in the streets.
And you're living at peace.
Yeah, relative peace. You're not necessarily bombing anybody. That's kind of what you're getting in Japan, and yet this is what they've got. They've got a whole forest dedicated to suicide. Sayed, sorry, your point.
Yeah, it's basically, it goes back to the society itself. Like, obviously, as Sheikh Yasser have mentioned, there must be a bigger goal that you need to achieve. In the Japanese society, unfortunately, we see like they don't have, they're doing everything for this world,
mm.
and because they don't have any belief in hereafter, for example, that's why they're stuck with this world. Because when you say this world is everything, and there is nothing beyond it, then there is a point where people get sick of what they're doing. And they get frustrated. For example, in the Japan, there is a culture of isolating self in a house for maybe at least 6 months, or sometimes they said like it's from 1 to 2 years, or maybe 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
People do isolate themselves, and in their culture,
Wait, yeah,
they
no,
call
I've
it
heard
as
of that.
Hikikomori.
Yes, I've heard
hikikomori
of that.
Or
that?
Hikikomori. They do that. Obviously, it's in their culture. They say like it's
uh-huh.
it was in the Japanese culture. That the people, and in 2010, one of the BBC reports, it said like in 2010, there were 700 people who isolated themselves, and average age of those people were 31 years old.
Whoa.
And most of them were the men.
Whoa.
Now, when you look at the figures of 2010,
mm.
and now this pandemic, with this corona pandemic that we have,
mm.
obviously, it will be raised, obviously. And also on top of that, we can see like, you know, have you seen the animes or
yeah.
animations that have
Some,
made
I haven't
it?
Seen any.
For example,
Are
Death
you?
Note.
Pokemon.
I've seen Death Note, yeah.
What is Death Note? What they're trying to teach the kids. There is
yeah.
a book you can kill and it's very easy. And then there's an investigator who's... So basically in their culture, in their TV, in their shows, we can see, obviously they're promoting this thing.
Mm-hmm.
When they're promoting this culture, you know, if government is really, if the government wants to stop people from suiciding, from doing suicide or committing suicide, they should make laws accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
But where we can see, like in Japan, they have said, like, you can do suicide, but you can use these means or these tools
wow.
to kill yourself. You cannot just go and jump out of the
yeah.
building.
Because
these
you're
going to
mess
means.
Up the street.
Yes, the way you give the way you give the example of jungle.
Mm.
So it's free for them to go mm. there. But whereas the governments who want to stop people from suiciding, from committing suicide, obviously they put their efforts towards that.
Mm.
They come up with the new ideas, or they get connected to the other religions, for example,
mm.
somehow to promote something, somehow to stop this thing. But we don't see these things. And I don't think like this new ministry, like the Ministry of Loneliness, can help
It's the roots of the society.
Yes.
Could you just say that? Did you have something to say?
No, I just want to say what Ed was saying. Like, no matter, government has obviously tried, but they're looking at it in the wrong way. If you have everything already that is material to you, what else are you going to give people? Mm. What else can I give you
that
is in my power?
Yeah.
I'm looking at the issue in the wrong way.
Right. Ahsan. Say it. Could you just say that Japanese phrase again?
Hikikomorai.
It really sounds
Hikikomorai.
Doesn't he sound like That's all we have time for today. From myself, from Sayyid Mohsin, and from Sheikh Yasser, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمّا رزقك يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي ما رايزك لا تعصي دينعتك وانسك
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Risks shoot up when virus particles accumulate in buildings, but it's not clear how best to improve ventilation, says Diani Lewis, author, in an article published under the heading, Why Indoor Spaces Are Still Prime COVID Hotspots. Stay tuned for more. When Lydia Morozka leaves home, she takes with her a slick shoe-sized device that provides some sobering insights about the restaurants and offices she visits. Outside these buildings, her carbon dioxide monitor reads just above 400 parts per million, but indoors is a different story. Even in a seemingly spacious, high-ceilinged restaurant, the number sometimes shoots up as high as 2,000 ppm, a sign that the room has poor ventilation and could pose a risk for COVID-19 infection. Visual cues can be deceptive, even for Morozka, an aerosol scientist from Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia. The general public has no idea about this, she says. The situation is no different inside cafes or kindergartens around much of the world, according to researchers who have wielded similar handheld CO2 meters. And that's bad news for hopes of defeating the coronavirus SARS-CoV-2. For months, health authorities have singled out indoor spaces with poor ventilation as potential infection hotspots. And on March 1st, the World Health Organization, WHO, released a long-awaited roadmap to better ventilation. The document, which Morozka contributed to, sets out specific targets and measures that businesses and other places can take to improve ventilation and make buildings safer. But Philomera Blusin, a building engineer at the Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands, says that more needs to be done. The WHO guidelines, she says, are the minimum. Blusin and others are critical of government's failure to provide clear guidance or money for people to make indoor spaces safer. Some scientists say that has been large swathes of the population, from school children to office workers, restaurant-goers and prisoners at risk of catching COVID-19. Others say that there is no easy fix, and the precise ventilation or air purification regimes to make indoor spaces safe are not known. The complexity is not at a level that you can, with a simple set of advice, resolve it, says Ehsan Musavi, a construction engineer at Clemson University in South Carolina, who studies indoor air quality and ventilation in hospitals. Still, many experts say that enough is known for authorities to provide clear message about how important good ventilation is for safety indoors, especially in spaces that are continuously occupied or where masks are removed when eating. On March 28, 2020, 2 months after the WHO had declared COVID-19 a global health emergency, the agency broadcast a public health message on Twitter and Facebook. Fact: COVID-19 is not airborne, it said, labeling claims to the contrary as misinformation. But evidence quickly established that the virus is transmitted by air, and researchers roundly criticized the agency. WHO updated its advice on SARS-CoV-2 transmission 3 months later, acknowledging the possibility that airborne transmission might occur in some community settings. Airborne transmission in crowded and inadequately ventilated spaces over a prolonged period of time with infected persons cannot be ruled out, the updated advice says. Yuku Li, a building environment engineer at the University of Hong Kong, says that he is disappointed it took the WHO and other health authorities so long. We would have saved a lot of people if airborne transmission was recognized earlier, he says. A WHO spokesperson says the agency has mentioned the importance of ventilation since early in the pandemic. Others say that the WHO's position still doesn't go far enough. Airborne transmission is dominant, says environmental epidemiologist Joseph Allen at Harvard University's T.H. Chan School of Public Health in Boston, Massachusetts. That's why building controls such as ventilation and air filtration makes sense, he says. The WHO and other health authorities have failed to clearly prioritize measures to improve indoor air quality to reduce the chance of catching COVID-19, says Jose Luis Jimenez, an atmospheric chemist at the University of Colorado at Boulder. They don't emphasize how important it is, he says. What the WHO needs to say is, fact, it goes through the air, says Jimenez. We breathe it in. A stark message from the WHO would ensure that national health authorities take notice, says Jimenez. Australia, the Netherlands, and some other nations still do not acknowledge in their public statement that airborne transmission has a significant role in spreading the SARS-CoV virus. By the start of this year, concerns over ventilation had reached the boiling point. Hundreds of healthcare workers, scientists, engineers, and occupational health and safety experts signed open letters calling on government officials in Canada, the United States, Australia, Colombia, and the UK to address, among other things, poor indoor air quality. These concerted campaigns all urged local or national governments to take steps to reduce airborne transmission of SARS-CoV-2. One of the problems is that governments and businesses are still spending millions of dollars on surface disinfection, says Jimenez, despite evidence that it is rare for SARS-CoV-2 to pass from one person to another through contaminated surfaces. By contrast, few countries have invested in measures to improve indoor air quality. If we took half the efforts that's been given to disinfection and we put it on ventilation, that will be huge, Jimenez says. In October, Germany set aside 500 million euros to improve ventilation in public buildings, including schools, museums, and public offices. Businesses in Germany and South Korea can also apply for government funding to purchase mobile air purifiers that remove virus-laden aerosols. In the United States, by contrast, federal funding to improve indoor air quality was limited to healthcare providers such as hospitals until the American Rescue Plan Act, which also provides funding for schools, became law on March 11th. What makes indoor spaces so dangerous is that the virus can accumulate and infect people who do not have direct contact with an infected person. A prime example happened a year ago in Vietnam. 12 people became infected at a restaurant, but only 4 had close contact with the infected person. More recent outbreaks at gyms in Chicago, Illinois, and Hawaii have also occurred despite physical distancing of the attendees and capacity limits on fitness classes. Ever since the WHO acknowledged last year that airborne transmission could happen, public health agencies have emphasized the risk in crowded and poorly ventilated spaces. But the terminology is deceptive, says Morosco. You imagine a busy restaurant, she says. In reality, any place can become crowded and poorly ventilated, and people don't realize this. Her own modestly sized office at the Queensland University of Technology quickly becomes poorly ventilated if someone visits and the door is closed, she says. And spacious, uncrowded restaurants can appear to be well ventilated when they are not. It's one of the reasons that Jimenez and others advocate the use of inexpensive CO2 monitors as a rough measure of whether ventilation is adequate or not. As virus-carrying aerosols are exhaled, so too is CO2. And when ventilation is poor, CO2 accumulates along with the virus, says Jimenez. In an unreviewed analysis, Jimenez and his co-author Zhi Peng found that SARS-CoV-2 infection risk rises along with CO2 concentrations indoors.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.